This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll begin our conversation on this Thursday with a chance to talk with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez, Jr. Sheriff Martinez, Jr., thank you for joining us in the studio today.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thank you very much, and good afternoon.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon to you. Let's jump in and talk about some very important, sad topics, and unfortunately very sobering, to be sure. We are all very much aware of the opioid crisis in Northwest Indiana in particular, and in Lake County in particular, with the stats bear out the fact that there are too many addictions to begin with, too many overdose deaths to go along with all that, too. Bring us up to date on how things seem to shape up in Lake County and what kind of efforts that you and your colleagues at the Sheriff's Department are trying to do to deal with that and with the hopes of trying to kind of erase the crisis.
Right. Well, this morning we just finished a workshop with the session with the County Council where we got approved again the niche grant. That is strictly a heroin grant that's state and federally funded that Lake County Sheriff's Department has. We work in conjunction with other counties, Stark County, Porter County, LaPorte County, St. Joseph County, Jasper, and Newton County. So all the Northwest Indiana counties that we work along with, we've increased our patrols in narcotics investigation and in highway interdiction, where our interdiction officers have been seizing a number of opioids and heroin narcotics that's coming into Lake County from various parts of the nation.
Yeah, I know you worked very hard on that, and when you came back in as the sheriff, you worked very hard to make sure that those units were back on the street.
Absolutely,
again.
And I've been with the Sheriff's Department for 26 years, and that was my expertise, about 17 years in narcotics, and so I'm very passionate about that. And with the funding and the increased patrols, and that's just on the enforcement side. We've also dealt with programs inside our jail, the Vivitrol program that I discussed probably about a year ago.
Yeah,
We have the judges involved, Judge Murphy, Judge Cantrell, in the meetings, working along with our outreach program as well, and mental health, and our doctors inside the jail, and identifying those that suffer with this addiction. So we have a treatment program as well inside our jail. The Vivitrol program is pretty much a shot. You have to qualify to be part of this program. You got to have you get screened and got to be pretty much evaluated that this is what you really want to do. You got to want to help yourself and want to change. Mm-hmm. And those people that are selected go through this program through detox, and just before going into the reentry program with our reentry personnel, this narcotic or this shot is given to you, the Vivitrol, which is free taxpayer. It costs about $1,200 to $1,800 this shot, but we get that for free in our jail.
Wow.
And what that does, it blocks the opioid receptors in your brain, so you get no euphoria or anything for at least 30 days, which also helps with those suffering from alcohol addiction as well. So we're covering it on different bases, and starting a program also with Dr. Mascal and our mental health, helping those that are seeking before they come and to commit a crime or anything, seeking help, that we provide that help to with resources and organizations that are partnering up with the Lake County Sheriff's Department to help them out.
How many approximately would you say of people that end up being incarcerated in the county jail come in already addicted, or maybe they may have gone through some treatment, but they've fallen off the wagon, so to speak?
Well, that is a large number that does come into our jail with not just opioid or heroin addiction, but alcohol addiction is large as well.
That people it's just as bigger, if not a bigger problem, I guess, in a way.
Exactly. We are dealing with that and also trying to develop with Dr. Mascal and other social workers more of a kind of in-house treatment where we separate those that have that addiction from the general population and do it more as a recovery program while they're in our jail. And those that are sentenced to, 90, 120 a year, time in our jail, 2 years, that's, I think that will really help when we're just focusing on the recovery aspect of it.
Let's talk about the goals, the plans that you have for the Sheriff's Department, aside from what you've just mentioned here about about dealing with the opioid problem that you face at the county jail. How do things shape up for what you have planned for 2019?
Well, most importantly for 2019 is to get from under the Department of Justice oversight. Mm-hmm. We're pretty much there in compliance. They will do their next visit in the spring. I can tell you with the pay raises that we did for the correction officers, that is pretty much a 10% raise that we did within 3 years. So they were getting paid about just under $33,000 a year. So what happened was that there was a high turnover rate, hard to recruit correction officers to work in our facility or our organization. So what we did within the 3 years, next year will be the last year and their pay raise to get them up to $43,000, which is pretty much very close to the national average of correction officers. And we're starting to see it. We're getting a lot more candidates applying for the correction division. Our recruitment or retention has increased. So that's very important because that's one of the DOJ mandates is staffing. The other one is mental health. We're pretty much about the hours and time that inmates dealing with mental health spend outside of the cell of time that's organized with them, structured and unstructured time. So we're pretty much there as well. So, we're looking to professionalize the Lake County Sheriff's Department. Number one is always safety for my men and women in law enforcement and also for the citizens. We're conducting an RFP bid process for armored rescue vehicle. Mm-hmm. Currently, we have an old surplus of armored vehicle that's, 1979. That keeps breaking down on us. Well, it's time to evolve. The cost for that armored vehicle is about $360,000. But when you look at it in law enforcement equipment, that's pretty cheap. When you consider a garbage truck costs way more than that, an ambulance, a fire truck. And that is to keep, our men and women in law enforcement safe. Also the citizens from any type of active shooter or high-risk warrants. I think we're one of the only sheriff's department or agencies that has a SWAT team that has a fully staffed medical staff, a doctor, medical personnel, nurses that come along with us on the SWAT team. So that rescue vehicle will also be a certified ambulance to be prepared to treat anybody with serious wounds, God forbid, in any type of active shooter situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that that's what you have to be able to, since you have to sell this basically to the county council, since you're talking about such a high expense, you have to be able to show, I'm sure, that this thing is very multi-use vehicle, to
right.
be sure.
Yeah. And it's we did sell it to the county council, did approve it. It's now in the commissioner's hands. Mm-hmm. My understanding, it's not really costing taxpayers any money right now because it's we're hoping to get the funding through gaming. The profits through or the cut the proportions that we get through the gaming organizations. But nevertheless, I think the people, the citizens will see that this is money well spent, even if it was taxpayers' money. The commissioners have a role to do to make sure that what we're purchasing is not wasteful spending, regardless of where it's coming from. So I understand their role that we go through a bid process to make sure we get the best rescue vehicle that's out there and get what we paid for. So they have a responsibility as well to their citizens to make sure things are done right. So hopefully by this month, next month, God willing, everything goes well and we're able to get that crucial or important piece of equipment.
Now, you mentioned here just a moment ago when we were talking about the jail and about meeting the requirements for the federal Department of Justice to be able to get out of their supervision, mm-hmm. I guess, in a way, and things that you've had to improve at the jail. Salaries for your correction workers are one thing, to be mm-hmm. sure, make sure that the correctional officers and be able to keep the officers that you have hired is one thing. So you're talking about basically a pay raise situation to help them out. And also, too, I know that you have come in on a regular basis to ask for raises for all of the staff members, including the people that work on the streets. Yes. What's the latest situation about that?
We spoke about also getting a pay increase with the qualified mental health professionals that we did last year. Mm-hmm. Again, is paying them based on their qualification and education and what the national average is. What we did today, again, in the council workshop, preparing for the council meeting next week, that you probably saw in the newspaper, that the sheriff is asking for a 48% pay raise. When you really look at it.
That's in the headline. And
yes,
sure,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, it could be misleading, but what's going on is actually cost savings. What I did was cut about 8 positions from the sheriff's department, from the jail, and on the police side. So we're looking at a cost savings of over $100,000 to $150,000 in savings of cutting jobs that are not necessary. But the jobs that is necessary and using some of that money is you get what you pay for. So what we're doing is making sure that the bookkeepers, you know, when you're dealing with close to a $42 million budget, getting paid $25,000, $35,000 a year is just not going to cut it. Mm-hmm. So getting them up to close to the national average of the pay rate is what I'm doing. And most importantly, it's within my own budget. I'm not asking for additional appropriations. I'm actually saving money. Contracting out the food service with the jail is also saving a significant amount of money. And so at the end of the day, it's within my own budget. The money is based on the national average of what a citizen should get paid for, or an employee should get paid for the job that they're doing. And it's saving the taxpayers over $150,000. You know, you'll hear comments like, it must be nice to be a county employee to get these pay raises. Actually, it's not. The county civilian employees really don't get paid that much, and government pay overall, mm-hmm, compared to the private sector. So, you know, we're just making sure, again, running a professional, efficient organization is number one.
In the time that we have left, Sheriff Martinez, let's talk a little bit about something that you're very much familiar with. You've spent a lot of your career, I know, literally being on the road, mm-hmm, as a sheriff's deputy on the road, and you've come up through the ranks that way too. How are things doing for the officers, the sheriff's deputies, and the other people that have to be out there on road patrol as their jobs, basically, which you've had to do? How are they doing these days, and how are things shaping up to make life better for them, if you can?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. I know the morale is up. I've invested so much money in the patrol division, and they have equipment and training that they never had before. Right now, we've invested so much equipment in active shooter kits. That's ballistic vests that stops high power rifles, ballistic helmets, patrol rifles. They've received a lot of the training for active shooters to deal with on a quarterly basis. We've also just yesterday I met with the Chief Sanchez of the Chicago Police Department Organized Crime, along with Undersheriff Parker of Cook County. So we've met with them yesterday to work alongside, partnering up with the multi-jurisdictional task force that we're going to create with our drug task force, our high crime unit, because crime has no boundaries. And a lot of crime bleeds over into Illinois, and a lot of crime bleeds over into Indiana. And we need to be working together because we're all investigating the same people, the same crime, and working together and having those contact informations to help each other is very important.
You probably find in having a chance, even though it's not very often, to meet with your fellow sheriffs, when you get to counties like Lake County that are on the corners of the state, we're talking, mm-hmm, about, in this case, the northwest corner, and you've got, of course, in southwest Indiana as well, too, around Evansville. Mm-hmm. All of the corner counties tend to have the most problems because you have more states where the instances of crimes happen, and you've, right, got that flow of criminals that can come either way, and it's very difficult to deal with that, I imagine.
Yes, it is, and I'm proud of our department and how we evolved. We were a very specialized department with an aviation unit, a canine unit, a narcotic unit, and a marine unit, SWAT division, warrant division. I mean, this is right now, I would say this is the best place to be in law enforcement. So many opportunities and making a big difference here in the community, and I'm committed to that.
Well, Sheriff Martinez, we'll have to leave it at that for now, and we hope to have you back to talk again soon. soon. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here. Thanks.
We've been talking here in studio with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Northwest Indiana residents who suffer from dementia and other cognitive issues and their caregivers can still enjoy a cruise in the Caribbean despite their illnesses because of the work of a Hobart High School and Ball State University Nursing School graduate. Kathy Shove created Elite Cruises and Vacations because of her experiences as a nurse, and she was with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
I was the director of nursing and regional director for senior living options for home health agencies, for hospice communities, and I just wanted somehow to create a way that everyone could still enjoy their life. I wanted to give families, loved ones, caregivers the opportunity to still enjoy their loved ones' experiences with their loved ones, with their families, without any barriers. So we create travel options for clients with cognitive impairment, dementia, COPD, heart issues, cancer complications, Alzheimer's disease, weakness, slow walkers, Parkinson's, and any other conceptual medical issue that exists. I travel with a group of professionals, including additional RNs, and we see that everyone has a safe, comfortable, happy experience.
What's it like to be able to set up your business to work with so many professionals as well as members of the family of the people who are really, I'm sure, enjoy the cruises as much, if not more so, than other people do? What's it like to be able to work with all these professionals and, in turn, working with the cruise lines, since you have, in this case, you're working with the Holland American Cruises?
The professionals that I work with are very, very carefully handpicked. We all have a very like-minded attitude to get the job done, because I don't necessarily have the ability to anticipate what complications, challenges might exist, and we have to be prepared to handle all of those challenges and meet the needs of not only our clients but all of their caregivers. Number one priority, keeping everyone safe, and number two, providing an experience which allows them to have lifelong amazing memories. As far as working with the cruise lines, I'm also very careful how I choose those cruise lines. We work with Holland America and Celebrity Cruise Lines because they are anxiously willing to be supportive and communicative about what I need their staff to do in order to make this successful. I have had the privilege to have dinner with the president of Holland America. I meet with the full cruise ship staff, including the captain and his other officers, before we ever sail. Everyone's fully aware of what challenges we are bringing on board his ship. But on the other hand, he has an MD on every single ship, and I do not hesitate to send a client to see a doctor if we have an issue. And I assure him that we will manage, you know, situations and problems as they arise and seek professional assistance as needed.
Mm-hmm. Are you aware, if it just happens to be in this case, what you mentioned with Holland America, that this particular cruise line has thought so well ahead in being able to take advantage of having passengers of this type on board their ships? Maybe some of the other cruise lines, if they haven't already, that they might be following suit, and you'll be having more opportunities out there for more cruises?
At this time, Holland America is excited about the opportunities. Like I said, Celebrity is also. I don't see that kind of conversation coming from any other lines right now.
Uh-huh.
But Holland America, and between Holland America and Celebrity, I can honestly travel with clients any place in the world, literally on all seven continents, any place in the world that anyone would wish to go. There's no exclusions. We are willing to take a group to take to whichever parts of the world they are interested in going. And we have 9 cruises scheduled for 2019 right now, which will be created in groups. And we're more than happy to add to that list with someone showing interest.
Well, it sounds like this is a great opportunity for people who maybe would never, ever have a chance to be on a cruise ship anytime during their life and during the time that maybe that they might need some help and certainly an opportunity to enjoy themselves the most. It sounds like the Kathy, you and others that you work with Elite Cruises and Vacations are on the right track and you've got plenty of things planned. So you're going to keep a lot of people busy on taking advantage of a lot of cruises in the future. And we're glad that you spent some time to talk about this with us today.
Thank you so much. I receive many accommodations and wonderful, happy clients that come and return and travel with us repeatedly. You know, we're always seeking to be able to have new first-time clients to our group, but many of our cruisers, travelers come back and travel with us additionally again.
Kathy Shove spoke with us from one of the cruise ships that she has to travel on for her project. And since our conversation, she's also had a chance to talk with Gary Dick on Inside Indiana Business Television. Indiana's launched a new work requirement program through Medicaid this month called Gateway to Work, and it's being billed as a community engagement opportunity to help connect people with better employment opportunities. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan says that some of the concerns are out there that Hoosiers might lose health insurance.
Indiana was one of the first states to apply for and receive a federal waiver to implement work requirements for the state's Medicaid expansion program, HIP 2.0. Indiana's Gateway to Work launched at the beginning of this year. Jennifer Walthall is the state's Family and Social Services Administration's, or FSSA, secretary.
It's actually more about connecting people to things that they haven't been able to be connected to before.
Things like education and transportation. Indiana is only the second state to make the move, and the FSSA set a goal early in the process.
We're not going to lose people because of a reporting requirement or an administrative burden or something along those lines.
But many worry they will, and there is precedent for this worry. In Arkansas, the first state to implement similar requirements, more than 12,000 residents lost their health insurance. Many couldn't easily access the online-only reporting system. But Walthall says Indiana's system is easy and user-friendly, and not all online. Members can log work, volunteer, or school hours on computer, by phone, and in person, and they don't have to have documentation.
They'll just go in and say, hey, I volunteered for 20 hours this week, check, and it goes right through and gets the job done. We're not trying to make this a full-time job. We're actually trying to help people get real full-time jobs, and so we don't want to get in their way.
The state will work through existing workforce development programs to help people find better employment. Gateway to Work gives people a list of what it calls partners to help them find jobs or volunteer opportunities. So far, there are more than 200 listed on the website.
We would like to have a cohort of people that are looking for those who have been disenfranchised for a long time and help us do our job better. We can't do this by ourselves.
But some partners are skeptical. Maurice Young works with people relying on Medicaid. He's an advocate for people experiencing homelessness in Indianapolis. Every Wednesday, he hands out bagged lunches at the Central Library.
There you go. You're welcome.
He and his small team also help people navigate health care coverage for HIP 2.0 and other programs.
And then Keenan over there, he does Humana for people who don't know that there's extra benefits that they get after they're on it for a year or so.
Young feels like FSSA is relying too much on the partners who work with these communities.
And it's so funny because when you read through the presentation, the partners do the work, right? The partners are the ones supposed to find the volunteer opportunities. Okay, I can find volunteer opportunities, but how am I supposed to get them there? This is your program. Get them some bus tickets.
He'd rather see a carrot than a stick approach.
Just open it up and offer it, but don't require it as a quid pro quo for your health.
Not all recipients of HIP 2.0 are subject to the new work requirement restrictions. A majority of the more than 400,000 Hoosiers on HIP 2.0 will be exempt for a number of reasons, including age, medical frailty, substance use disorder, and homelessness. But Young says those categories aren't clear in real life. Homelessness is not clear.
Those institutions have different definitions of homelessness. So give me that information.
FSSA Secretary Jennifer Walthall knows it will be hard to reach every one of the estimated 70 to 80,000 people who may have to comply with the work changes. They've gone through partners, providers, and reached out directly to members through email or letters to get the word out.
The hardest folks to reach are the most important to reach.
Members aren't required to report any hours the first 6 months. The full 20-hour-a-week requirement won't be in place until 2020. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's take up a topic now on the program. It's one of these that you either get really, really angry, or you just kind of sit here and shake your head about it. And it's dealing, of course, with public corruption here in Northwest Indiana. And we are turning to Mark Chase with the Times of Northwest Indiana to talk about it. Mark, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, as we said, it's a question, I guess, whether you want to get really angry and shake your fist, or you just want to sit and shake your head, I suppose. And probably we're not alone in feeling that way.
Yeah, it's probably equal measures of both, especially when we hear from our readers about the recent happenings with former Lake County Councilman Jamal Washington.
Let's do a little timeline here. Talk about this, and this is a topic we've brought up before and has come up before in other cases. In fact, just as recently as stories that have come out of Porter County, and now we've got that back into the news too, in addition to what else has happened here in Lake County. Let's do the timeline issue first and talk about Mr. Jamal Washington and the issues that he seems to be bringing up.
Sure. Well, of course, up until last year, Jamal Washington was a Lake County councilman. He was representing, he lived in Merrillville. He was representing parts of the North County on the Lake County Council. And in 2015, he had his first arrest for domestic violence. It was a case involving his wife and a employee and subordinate from his from the company that he worked for in the private sector who was living with he and his wife. There were, it was a pretty ugly case. There was choking that was alleged. There was beating that was alleged. Ultimately, Jamal was arrested. By 2016, he was allowed to plead guilty in a plea deal. A lot of the charges were dropped. He ended up pleading guilty to misdemeanor battery against his wife in that case. It was either the same day or the day after that the guilty plea was taken. He was seen going to a party and organizing a party up at a Merrillville restaurant, which he invited other politicos to celebrate the fact that he wasn't going to have to resign because it wasn't a felony conviction.
Mm-hmm.
A year later, Jamal was arrested again by Merrillville police in a domestic violence case alleging battery against his cousin. That case went to trial. The trial was in late 2018, and he ended up being convicted in that case of misdemeanor battery as opposed to the felonies that he originally faced. He was sentenced to essentially no jail time, so the only time he served in jail was 15 days after his arrest in December of 2017 for his probation violation. Even though the judge decided that he was in violation of his probation in the previous case, he was not given any jail time in addition to what he'd already served. So that brings us to the very cold, negative 20-degree day last week, and we woke up to news that Jamal was being arrested and being forcibly removed from the home in Gary that he was sharing with Gary City Councilwoman Lavetta Sparks-Wade, who is also a Gary mayoral candidate. He was sharing the home with her. Apparently they were boyfriend-girlfriend, and it's alleged now that for 16 hours he kept her against her will and was beating her in that house. And he now, as we speak, sits in jail on a 15-day hold in yet another domestic violence case. And I think we can expect sometime within the next week or so that the special prosecutor in the case will be seeking a revocation of Jamal's probation in the assault against his cousin. So the merry-go-round keeps turning, and Jamal seems to have, through either plea deals or light jail sentences, he seems to have still been out there and still been able to assault yet another woman if the allegations that we are hearing are correct.
I've also noted, too, that in addition to what has actually happened, that we have now Ms. Sparks-Wade actually, through a statement, not talking necessarily to reporters, but just a statement that's been made, and I guess, too, it's probably come up, I suppose, in even some of the legal paperwork with the affidavit of probable cause that had to be filed in Mr. Washington's case, that she has commented and that she has said, at least in her statement, we know that's been in the Times and other media, that she has felt she's been not only betrayed, but she's been definitely deceived by Mr. Washington and all this. And this is probably something else, another layer to all of this, too, that I'm sure that will probably come out when it comes back up in court.
Yes. Well, I mean, if the allegations are true, she has a right to feel betrayed. She was one of Jamal's biggest supporters, and even a lot of criticism that she received, especially from the community of women in Northwest Indiana, was that she stood by Jamal through his two previous cases of domestic violence. Even when he was pleading guilty or even when he was being convicted of a misdemeanor battery, she still stood by him and believed he was a good guy. And frankly, I offered a lot of criticism up against Jamal over the years in my columns because of all these things and because of a number of protective orders that were taken out against him by other women not related to those cases. And she was an ardent critic of my commentary for quite a while. And, you know, there were people in the Jamal camp that were even referring to me as racist for, you know, picking on him because, you know, he's an African American. And, of course, we were writing about this because it was a public official involved in domestic violence, which is a very serious matter. So she has a right to feel betrayed because she stood by him even through that. And I think now it would seem to me that she's beginning to see the light on what actually may have been going on here, of course, if these allegations are to be believed. Yeah.
I know that you mentioned the fact in the recent article that we were talking about here for the program today talks about the fact that maybe that she should not, I guess it's probably an uncomfortable feeling, certainly for her, but she should be at least considered as a hero in some respects.
Yeah, I certainly made that case in my column. I mean, she has the ability to rise as one, that's for sure. You know, some of the other women in his other cases, and this is not uncommon in cases of domestic violence, the cousin recanted for a short time and then came back and said, no, this actually did happen. I want to continue on and press the charges. I believe his wife in the first case showed quite a bit of support for him even after he pleaded guilty to battering her. So, you know, this is a common situation where the victim feels like they're somehow subservient or in the control of the abuser. In this case, she seems to be acknowledging that that's a common thread, but at least from her early statements, appears ready to push this and to make sure that he's fully prosecuted for what's alleged to have occurred here.
Now, coming back in your discussions with your colleagues there at the Times on all that has happened here in particular, the latest criminal charges that have been filed against Jamal Washington, and now we have this extra layer we mentioned about the fact that he'll be back in Porter County dealing with the revocation of probation, which he had received from the judge on the case over there. I suppose it's just a matter of time, I suppose, before it all comes about to whether that there are felony charges that will actually be levied against Mr. Washington and how he's going to have to face those and what, if any, political future he may have.
Yeah, of course, the one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is that Jamal is an active candidate for Gary City Council at large right now as he lives in the home where Lovetta Sparks Wade lives. Now, I think we can probably make a pretty safe bet that he's not going to be welcome back in that house, mm-hmm. based on what we've heard from Lovetta. So I think we can also make a pretty safe bet that they're going to be pushing for revocation of his probation. If that happens, he could face up to 180 days in jail, in addition to the 15-day hold that he's on now, and we'll probably see that filing for revocation sometime close to the expiration of the 15 days, and we'll see a hearing, I would imagine, before that happens. But then, you know, even with that revocation and any jail time he faces there, he also has been charged again with 5 felony counts in relation to the alleged assault and confinement of Lovetta Sparks Wade. So Jamal, with a cooperating witness as strong as I think she can be, may face quite a bit of trouble here.
And I imagine, too, that if it does come down to that, if there are 5 felony charges, even should he even decide to plead guilty to only one of them, I suppose that just one felony charge alone is going to basically mean that he's not going to be eligible for public office again, ever.
That's true. Under Indiana law, any felony conviction automatically negates you from being able to hold public office, from being able to hold elected office.
So I guess once again it comes back to what we started mentioned at the outset of our conversation here about the fact that it's a case where you can either shake your fist angrily at everything about this, or you can just sit there and shake your head sadly about what has happened here, and it's not over yet. I hate to say the fat lady singing, you know, but that's the analogy you can use here, that it ain't over until it's over. So that's what we're going to face in this case too. So I'm sure we're going to be finding more stories come out here in the Times about this and more commentary as well too. that'll come up in the opinion pages that you're going to mention as well, too, Mark, I imagine.
No, absolutely. And look, the system actually, it has an opportunity to get this right this time. This pattern has gone on and on, and just like it does with victims of domestic violence, you often see the same victims being beaten multiple times before it's reported, or multiple times before they'll go forward, or sometimes they don't go forward, and we know how that ends. This is a situation where the system has a chance to get it right this time, too, and I really hope that the authorities here take that opportunity.
Mark Chase is the local news editor for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and as always, Mark, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you.
On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Giles Bruce with the Times of Northwest Indiana on stories that he has put out there online and in print in the newspaper. And Giles, the first story I've got up here to check with you on is a story really that is kind of based in LaPorte County, but it branches out across the state. It's because the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation is handing out money to organizations to try to stem the flow of opioid overdose deaths in the state. And you have the local angle to this here. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation is based in Indianapolis. They're a funding organization that their main goals right now are reducing opioid addiction and tobacco use. Their work, because of where they got the money, their money can only go to Marion County, mm-hmm. But they're actually sharing their ideas and their programs, essentially free of charge with other parts of the state and foundations in other parts of the state. So LaPorte County, and the city of LaPorte specifically, because of the sale of LaPorte Hospital in 2016, has what's called the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte, which is an organization with tens of millions of dollars to spend on health and wellness in that county. So they are using a program that did start in Indianapolis by the Fairbanks Foundation, but they're bringing a new version of it up here, and it's essentially going to bring drug prevention programs into schools in LaPorte County.
Well, tell us why LaPorte County seems to be a good target for being able to use the funds, at least from the foundation, and to try and fight off the opioid crisis in LaPorte County.
Yeah, LaPorte County, does have among the highest rates of drug overdose deaths in the state. The number of residents seeking treatment for opioid addiction rose by 137% from 2010 to 2017. Mm-hmm. And injection drug use grew there by 188% in that time. But we did a story last year. We analyzed what communities in Northwest Indiana had the most drug overdose deaths.
Yeah.
And the community of LaPorte had more per capita overdose deaths than any community in Northwest Indiana we found in a recent 5-year period. So they have a particularly bad opioid addiction problem there. So this healthcare foundation is thinking that one of the more effective ways to get at that problem is to prevent people from getting addicted in the first place.
Now, I understand you had a chance to talk with Maria Fruth, who's the president and CEO of the Healthcare Foundation of LaPorte. How did she get word that the Richard M. Banks Foundation would offer their ideas, kind of pass on the expertise that they have picked up so they could create their own local operation there?
She works in this field, so she met somebody from the Fairbanks Foundation and found out that they were, offering this sort of advisory service to other foundations around the state. So they, essentially mirrored the Marion County program. That one is called Prevention Matters. The one here in LaPorte County is called Partners in Prevention, but mm-hmm. it's essentially the same thing. They give offer grant opportunities to local schools and a list of evidence-based programs for them to choose from. There's a little over 20 programs that these schools have to choose from. They have to be sort of based in evidence and studied and found to have been effective in other places. The woman who runs the Fairbanks Foundation told me that the DARE program, which is a popular one, isn't one of these programs because that is found to not be very effective. So, so they are sort of giving out this money for these schools to plan, which programs they're going to choose and how they're going to implement them.
We're talking with Giles Bruce, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. One of the other stories that you have out there that you can check out in more detail follows up with a local story which has just come out recently about reports of a sexual abuse of a child. At least it's end up with the arrest of a man from Washington Township. And you had a chance to check with some local experts to find out how parents should really bring up the subject of sexual predation with their youngsters. And tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a hard topic for parents to broach with their kids, but you know, a lot of experts say that it's necessary, it's vital to protect kids, to give them the ability to know what's appropriate and what's not, when it comes to things like touching and sexually inappropriate behavior from adults and even from other children. So these experts told me that, there's essentially no magic number for what age you should start with. They said you should sort of kind of go by, how mature your kid is and then incorporate the lessons from there, try to weave it into everyday conversations. They said with young kids, you can, there are children's books out there that, explain it in a way that young kids, can understand. So that's, kind of a starting point.
I understand that in one particular case, I guess one expert you talked to had, some very good advice from based on some of the books here in particular. I guess what kind of lessons do you learn, or did she say that you learned from these books? Like one that has a title as "My Body Belongs to Me." What's the best advice I guess they can offer a parent to be able to pass along to their youngsters?
Yeah, I mean, these experts told me things like, that this is your body, no one has the right to touch you, tell your parents if something inappropriate does happen, people who are sexual predators of children might say that it's a game or it's their secret or they might make threats,
yeah.
But you have to tell your parents and tell authorities and, nobody should be, no adults, other than your parents or a doctor should be seeing you naked. It's okay to say no, things like that. You also have to monitor their online activities because that's where a lot of this predation starts. And these predators try to groom kids and then try to meet up with them in person after that.
I guess, too, it's also important for youngsters to tell their parents who their friends are, so that then it just goes along with when you let your youngsters go out to visit friends, like a sleepover, like was what is the instance here that led to the arrest of this one man in particular there in Washington Township. It's just wise to know who the youngsters are with all the time.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, in the one at Washington Township, the 14-year-old girl was allegedly, according to reports, sleeping over at a friend's house, and then this man knew someone who lived there and was there, and then preyed on her allegedly. So it's always good to know, obviously who your kids are friends with, where they're going, who's going to be there, those kind of things. Because as one of the experts told me, it's usually not this big scary boogeyman that jumps out of a van and grabs you and hauls you into the van. It's oftentimes someone you know or are acquainted with.
Well, some uncomfortable topics to talk about, but have to be told and talked about with the parents and youngsters alike. And you've been able to bring that up here in your story. Giles, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on these two very important topics, not only drug overdose deaths and how one community in LaPorte County in particular is helping to deal with it, but here the question of how to talk with your children about sexual predators. We do appreciate you spending some time going over the stories with us today.
Pleasure, Chris. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you. Giles Bruce is a reporter for the Times of Northwestern Indiana. A Ball State University graduate who's from Whiting was part of a team that, while still in college, worked on a historic preservation project, a project that won second place in a national competition. Gwen Stricker is now working in her graduate degree at Columbia University in New York City, and she was with us to talk about the winning project while she was still attending the Muncie campus, a historic schoolhouse in southeast Indiana, about 4 hours away from Muncie.
One of the people on our team, her family has owned the little schoolhouse for a few generations, so she kind of sparked the idea. We knew that we wanted to compete in the competition. We were kind of searching around areas near Muncie, which is where Ball State is, so that we could find a structure that wasn't actually measured before with the HABS program. So it was kind of difficult to find one that hadn't been already submitted, but that one was a good fit. And it's a small, you know, one-room schoolhouse, one story, very simple. It's Italianate in style. And we really just researched it in the context of its history in the Indiana school system. So it's important not only for its architectural style, but also for its inclusion in the Indiana school system.
Now, this building is from 1862, and it's located in West Harrison, Indiana. Tell us about West Harrison and what made it so interesting to visit down there. That's in the neighborhood down by Cincinnati, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we didn't really spend a whole lot of time in the town itself. We basically just stayed on the site at the schoolhouse. But West Harrison, it's part of the larger network of schoolhouses, and this is actually one of the only remaining ones. So that's kind of what made West Harrison important in examining the history of Indiana school systems.
What is it about these schoolhouses that seem to be very interesting? What is it about the design that intrigued you and the other members of the student team?
Well, we thought that it was interesting that even though it was a rather conservative little schoolhouse, they have sort of ways of articulating the facade in a more ornate way. So using bricks and using materials that would have been from local places in a way that kind of made it more special without, you know, breaking the budget.
Now, you got to spend an entire semester working on the information and all the paperwork, I guess, in getting the request in the competition submitted. Tell us more about what kind of work that you've had to do for research from start to finish on this.
Sure. So I was partially involved in the research side of it, but mostly I was involved in the AutoCAD work. So after we measured the building, I went into the AutoCAD program, which is a drafting program that most architectural firms use. And we drafted each facade, the floor plans, a section cut through the building so that you could understand the interior relationship with the exterior. You know, also drawing little details like windows and some of the ornamental features that I was talking about earlier. So that was the bulk of my work. We also compiled a few images that would help to show the condition of the building, since it has sat kind of vacant for several years. It's in a little bit of disrepair, but nothing that a little work couldn't help. So that was the bulk of my work, was kind of documenting the current condition of the building.
Now, you had a chance to make the submission to the Charles E. Peterson Prize competition for this year, and you've now come up with, and the rest of the team come up as winning second place in the competition. When did you find out that you made it to second place?
Found out in late July, and by that point, you know, I had already moved to New York. I was doing an internship this summer, and then I started at Columbia University in a graduate program. So I, you know, and the prize was awarded at the APTI conference in Buffalo. So I was close enough. Actually, most of the team was able to go and accept that award, which was really great to get everyone back together and be recognized for the work.
I understand that getting this competition prize certainly is well worth it for the monetary value that everybody gets from it. But there's also very important process that the Haspens, I understand as well, that not only did you do all the work on this particular little schoolhouse, but the drawings that you made and the information that you gathered helps be able to put that work in the Library of Congress. Tell us how the Library of Congress fits into this picture.
Actually, the Department of the Interior, which is a federally run department, they are in charge of most historic preservation work that's at the federal level. And so they oversee the National Register of Historic Places, which is a listing of any place. People can, you know, nominate buildings on their own, and we put together a nomination as well. But it's any place, you know, that you could argue has historic value. So it's listed in the National Register, and then the Library of Congress is what holds the Historic American Building Survey collection. And the Historic American Building Survey started in the 1930s. It was a program to help document U.S. historic properties at the time, and it's continued since it started then. And Charles E. Peterson was the person who started that, so that's why the prize is named after him.
Well, the Library of Congress, with all this information that they will have in their archives and all, it probably would help if they have to do work on the building or actually reconstruct the building if something happened to it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so if the building ever were to be damaged or destroyed, the drawings would definitely help. They're not construction drawings, so you couldn't just hand them off to, you know, someone and say, build this building. But they could definitely help someone to understand what the building was like, what it was constructed of, things like that. So it's important information, you know, to be archived, because if the building ever were to be lost, there's at least some sort of record of it and why it was important.
We're talking with Gwen Stricker from Whiting. She has been a Ball State student in architecture, and that's one of the things we want to find out more about here now. Tell us what kind of experience that you managed to pick up from being on the team and in this competition as far as wanting to be an architect.
Most I learned from this competition was really about observing, you know, historic buildings and being able to measure those buildings at the same time. We learned a lot of technical skills in terms of going and measuring, making, you know, measured sketches out in the field that could then be translated into computer drafting drawings. So that was really helpful, especially this summer when I was interning at a preservation architecture firm in New York.
Thank you very much, Gwen Stricker. She's a native of Whiting and a graduate now of Ball State University and in graduate school at Columbia University in New York City. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today on this Thursday, a Reporters Roundtable Thursday as well. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today and this week, and we'll be back with you on Monday.